All right, now, the slideshows that I'm going to show you are already on my website. That's the website, not Canvas. And if you've already looked through them, you've noticed probably already that there is very little text. This is not an accident. It's also not just laziness on my part. I intentionally keep a lot of text off of the slides. They're mostly just pictures from the textbook. Because I noticed that even if I tell students directly, do not write down this text, if there's text up there and I'm speaking, they will ignore what I'm saying and just write it down because they think, text, I better write that down. That's a total waste of time, all right, because you already have a copy of it on the website. Why write it again? So I don't do it. I just avoid that problem by not having very much text up there. And that way you're kind of forced to listen to me. I also have a red slide number at the bottom right of each slide that I will try to always mention when I move from slide to slide to make it easy to know which slide to look at while you're listening to the lecture recordings. And I really highly recommend drawing a line in your notes each time I transition and write down the new slide number so you can follow at home. Now, the idea here, the best way of approaching this preparation for giving your own lectures, which is what I recommend most, is to make your notes as good as possible during this live performance. You're not going to be able to get every word I say down if you're a normal person. That's no big deal, though. That's what the recordings are for, right? So write down some main points. Pay attention to me. That takes some of your concentration as well. And then listen to the recordings at home and make your notes a hell of a lot better. And make that is your study material. The very good final versions of the notes that you make are what you should study the hell out of to the point of being able to explain it without looking at anything. Okay, we'll start with slide one, of course, in this opening chapter, which is kind of a overview chapter of biology in general. And biology obviously has to do with living things, and living things are one type of object in the universe. The universe is really made up of three kinds of objects, one of which is living things. Does anyone know the other two? By the way, I would like us to be interactive, but I find that a lot of students really do not want to say anything in front of the class. And I can only assume it's because they think, oh, these other people are going to think I'm stupid, or I'm not sure of this. I'm not absolutely sure of this answer, therefore I shouldn't say it. Which is kind of silly when you think about it, because if you already knew all this stuff, why the hell would you be taking the class? You should be teaching it, right? So you're all in the same boat. You're going to be know certain things and not know other things. But give it a shot. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, as you're speaking more about that.
Three objects.
Yeah.
Three types of objects.
Yeah, so probably life, time, and space slash matter.
Well, it's all matter.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by objects. Three types of material objects in the world, one of which is living things. So if one of them is living things, non-living things is another. What's the third? If something is neither living nor non-living, what must it be? Well, that's non-living. People typically overthink this question. There's nothing fancy about it. You can't think of anything. If you're not living and you're not non-living, then you are dead. Dead things is the third. Dead and non-living are not the same thing, right? A stone is non-living because it never lived. A corpse is dead because it once lived. And living things are, of course, living things. So those are the three categories. But what does it mean to be alive? That's actually the more complicated thing to talk about. You know, we have a... You can ask a kindergartner whether something is alive. They'll be able to tell you. But what does that mean? What does it mean being alive? Life doesn't really have a nice, concise dictionary definition. Instead, we notice that all living things have certain characteristics in common. When you really get down to it, what we call life is metabolism. But what is metabolism? What would you give as a definition of metabolism? I mean, I'm sure everyone is familiar with the word metabolism in here, right? But what is it? It definitely, yes, energy metabolism is a big part of metabolism. But metabolism as a whole category refers to all of the chemical reactions that are occurring in an organism. And there are thousands of chemical reactions that are occurring not only in each of you, but in each of your individual cells. So there are quadrillions of chemical reactions occurring in the entire individual you. All of that combined is your metabolism. And that's what life really is. When you get down to it, life is really just biology, is chemistry. A special subset of chemistry. Biology is just chemistry. When you get down to it, chemistry is really just physics. Subset of physics. And physics, really, when you get down to it, is just math. So, really, everything is just math. But we're concerning ourselves with biology here. And the reason that I say that it's really just chemistry is not only because that's true, but because since this is Bio 181 and not 182, since we're looking at biology at the cellular level, which is where these chemical reactions are occurring, this course is going to seem for most of the term to be just as much a chemistry course as it is a biology course. Which is why having taken chemistry before coming into here is really helpful. I think it's only officially recommended. It's not a prerequisite, is it? It's kind of a weird situation because taking chemistry will help you in 181. Taking 181 before you take chemistry will help you in chemistry. So I don't know which is the better. Well, you can't really solve that problem. Taking them both at the same time might be a challenge, but it could also help both. Anyway, we're going to be talking a lot about chemistry. Anyway, back to this, what is life? Well, life is the chemistry that goes on in organisms. Now, what is an organism? Well, it's a living thing. That's another name for an organism. But how do I know whether something is an organism or not? There is one strict requirement for being an organism. Any idea what that is? No, there are the vast majority of individual organisms alive right now, and this has always been the case, do not have a nucleus. Bacteria are the most successful and the most numerous of all organisms. Close, though. You're close to what the true answer is. A nucleus is in what? If you have a nucleus, it's in what?
Membrane?
It's in a cell. Right? Is that what you're going to say? That is the absolute requirement to be an organism. You have to have at least one cell to be an organism. So there are some that have only one cell. Those are the unicellular organisms of the world. And there are those that are made up of more than one cell. We're good examples of that. Those are the multicellular organisms. If you don't have a cell, though, you don't have the little special chamber that a cell is that locks that batch of chemicals away from the environment so that that chemistry, that metabolism that we call life, can occur. And so there are things that are involved with organisms, like a virus you mentioned earlier. A virus is not an organism because it doesn't have a cell. It's much smaller than a cell. It's really just a set of a couple molecules. It clearly is a biotic entity, meaning it's involved with biology, with living things, but it doesn't metabolize. It's not alive. It causes your life to be different if it invades your cells, but it's not an organism. The organisms of the world, though, share these several characteristics on slide one. So this is really how we define life, by saying, if all of these things are true, and you're made up of at least a cell, you're an organism. There's no particular order to these. Let's just work clockwise, starting with response to the environment. The environment of an organism is just all of the surroundings. The surroundings, notice, include non-living, dead, and living things. So organisms interact with dead things, other living things, including other species and the same species. And they also interact with non-living things, the air, the water, whatever. Responding to changes in that environment is an important hallmark of living things. Living things will change their metabolism, their life, based on what's happening in that environment. Reproduction. Now, that's actually not a requirement. I mean, it's not a requirement that you actually go through with reproduction. Otherwise, I would not be an organism because I've chosen for my lineage to go extinct when I die. I'm not reproducing. But I have the capacity to, or we as a species do. Reproduction, of course, refers to making more individuals. That can be done either sexually or asexually, but organisms reproduce. That's an important part of life. Growth and development, really two things, but they're related. Growth refers to increase in size. Now, that can happen in two ways. For instance, when a bacterium, which is an individual organism, but it's a unicellular organism, when it reproduces asexually, it does so by binary fission, which means splitting into two, basically. Therefore, right at the start of those two new cells, they're not as big as the original cell, obviously, right? You've cut that one cell into two halves. So the individual cell can grow. But also growth refers in multicellular organisms to adding additional cells. Now, we are huge organisms, really. There's plenty of things that are much huger than we. But compared to the vast majority of individuals, we are big. But notice that we are not just a huge adult-sized cell. We all started out as one cell, but we became multicellular for reasons that I'll explain in a different chapter. And when we grow as a multicellular organism, we do so by adding more and more cells to our body. Development, on the other hand, is not really just about increasing the size. Development refers to delegating different jobs to different kinds of cells. And so we start out as one cell, the zygote. We become two cells, then four, then eight, and so on, keep doubling. But somewhere along the line, instead of just having identical cells, that this mass of cells, the early embryo, we start to develop, and certain cells will go in one direction and become liver cells and whatnot. They'll become different organs of the body, specializing in their functions. That's development. Energy processing, which is an important part of metabolism, which I've already said multiple times, is life. That really is a true hallmark of life. To be alive means to be processing energy continuously. We'll get much deeper into energy processing in its own chapter. That'll be for unit 3. But all organisms do it. All organisms process energy and materials, actually. You take in food, you turn it into different stuff, and in the process, and in the while you're doing that, energy gets processed. Regulation refers to Change is being made in organisms so that conditions are kept favorable for the organism. So regulation really has to do with homeostasis. Homeostasis is a word that means to stay the same. Stasis is staying. Homeo means the same. Biologically, a good definition of homeostasis is the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. So there's a lot of aspects to homeostasis. There's, for instance, thermostasis is just part of homeostasis. Thermostasis is maintenance of temperature, right? We as homeotherms, not all animals are homeotherms, but we are, we have to keep our body temperature within certain tight limits. We can't get too warm or too cold. And that's part of homeostasis. We have to maintain our pH as well. There's all kinds of aspects to homeostasis. But homeostasis is achieved by regulatory mechanisms that happen various ways depending on what part of homeostasis you're trying to achieve. But regulation refers to responding to the environment, really, because environment brings about changes that you want to counteract in order to stay in your safe zone. Above that is order. Now, this middle of this flower is a good example of something that is highly ordered, but certainly there are non-living things that are highly ordered as well, right? This just brings up the general point that even non-living things can have some of these qualities, but they won't have all of them. For order, for instance, I mean, crystals are a good example of something that is very highly ordered, right? A diamond, very highly ordered, but it's not alive because it doesn't do all these other things as well. Anyway, all organisms are highly ordered. Sometimes you have to look at the cellular level to see that order, but in order to do all these other things requires keeping things really very highly ordered at a molecular level. And then that leaves evolutionary adaptation, which includes two important terms in that, evolution and adaptation. Just in general terms, not biology necessarily, but just as language, what does evolution mean? What does evolve mean? Yeah.
To change.
To change, exactly. To evolve is to change. And evolution occurs not within individuals. This is really more of a Bio 182 topic. But evolution is really important for all of biology. It's not that individuals evolve, it's that populations of individuals evolve over generations. So evolution occurs between the generations. That's when the change occurs. It doesn't occur within individuals. That can occur in three major ways that I'm not going to get into here because it's a 182 topic. But of the three ways in which evolution can occur, in other words, of the three causes of evolution, there's only one that is adaptive, which means that by evolving, each successive generation gets better and better fit to their surroundings. The environment demands certain qualities in order for you to survive well in it. So adaptive evolution is the type of evolution that makes each successive generation a little bit better at living where they live. All right. And does anyone know what the mechanism is that causes that type of evolution? Adaptive evolution? Like I said, there's three causes to evolution, but there's only one adaptive cause of evolution. And that's what Darwin is famous for. Darwin's not famous for evolution. Darwin's famous for explaining the major way in which evolution occurs adaptively. That's natural selection. Natural selection is simply, it's a pretty simple concept, really. It's based on the fact that organisms not only reproduce, but when they do, they pass on heritable material, namely DNA, that defines characteristics of the offspring. And in any given population, there is variability because there's DNA variability. Not every individual is identical, right? So on an individual basis, from individual to individual, there are varying fitnesses. An individual's fitness is how well adapted that individual is for its particular situation, for its living environment. So there's going to be differences individual to individual in fitness. And with a low fitness, and for an individual that just randomly by the genetic draw of the deck has low fitness, it's going to be more likely that that individual will not live long enough to reproduce because of its low fitness. If it doesn't live long enough to reproduce, then its genes, its heritable factors, will not be passed on to the next generation. Whereas the ones that happen to draw a lucky hand and are well fit to the surroundings, they're going to be much more likely to pass on their genes. So the next generation is going to feature a higher percentage of well-fit individuals. That's natural selection. Nature is selecting, in a sense, not consciously, of course, simply by allowing the things that work to survive and killing off those that don't. Okay, so those are the major descriptors of organisms. It takes a long time to get through slide one. They're not all that long. Let's go to slide two. And here we're looking at the hierarchy of biological organization. Now, what is a hierarchy? That is a nested arrangement of things, right? It's a nested arrangement because in a hierarchy you have a certain level that includes some number of levels below it, each of which will include a certain number of levels below it, and so on. Like those nested dolls, right? We'll work from small to large here, which is against the direction of the arrows. I prefer to start small. At the low end, we have atoms. Now, atoms are not the smallest particles, of course. There are even smaller ones that make up atoms. But when you talk about those, you're really no longer in biology. You're talking about either chemistry or physics. Now, we'll get into that as well, but we'll start with atoms, inconceivably tiny structures from our point of view. It takes trillions and trillions of them just before we start seeing them visibly. But anyway, atoms is the low level within this hierarchy. And atoms of different kind or of the same kind gather together to make larger, more complex structures called molecules. Right? Like a water molecule is made up of hydrogen and oxygen atoms. Okay, so that's another level. By the way, this brings up the important point within biology of emergent properties. To emerge means to come out, right? So this term refers to the fact that in this hierarchy of organization, each higher level features properties that don't exist at the lower levels. For instance, using water as an example again. Water has properties that hydrogen atoms and oxygen atoms do not have, right? Water is watery. Hydrogen is not, oxygen is not. And then when you go up a level above that, you'll have new properties that emerge. And so that's an important biological concept. But above the level of molecules, when you have different kinds of molecules forming even larger structures, those larger structures are called organelles, which is a word that literally means little organ, because they are like organs within the body, only there are tiny organs within the cell. So organelles are subcellular structures, smaller than a cell. But they are collections of molecules arranged in such a way as to perform a specific function. And I'm sure you've heard of some of these things. We'll be talking about them later. Things like endoplasmic reticulum, mitochondrion, and whatnot. Those are organelles. Okay, next level up. You have different kinds of organelles collecting into a single cell, which is the functional unit of life for what I've, for the reasons I've already talked about, right? If you don't have at least one cell, you're not really an organism. These lower levels are important, but until you get to cell, you don't have an organism yet. Now, for a unicellular organism, there won't be the next several steps. Because a unicellular organism, like a bacterium, its cell is also the entire organism. So these ones that come between cell and organism, those apply only to multicellular organisms. You see what I'm saying there? Okay, so in us, for instance, typical multicellular animal, cells of different types form even larger and more complex structures called tissues. And depending on what kind of organism you're talking about, what species, there are different numbers of tissues. Anyone have an idea of how many tissue types there are in a human? No wild stabs?
1 million.
It's not quite. It's four. There is nervous tissue, connective tissue, epithelial tissue, and what did I not say? Muscle tissue. Now, other kind, that's true for mammals in general, but like a plant will have different tissues. In any case, multicellular organisms are made up of tissues. Tissues then of different types make even more complex structures called organs. Like the liver is an organ, the skin is an organ, so on. And then multiple organs that work together for a common function make up even more complex things called organ systems. What are examples of organ systems in us? Heart is an organ. So it's a member of an organ system, but what organ system is it a member of? Respiratory system is a good example. The heart is a member of the circulatory system. There's the lymphatic system, the reproductive system, and so on. There's 11 different human organ systems. Well, there's the pulmonary system is not an official organ system. Pulmonary simply means of the lungs. So it would include just the lungs. When you include everything that's involved in the entire system, it's called the respiratory system. Similarly, people use the term cardiovascular system, which is not really an organ system either. Cardiovascular literally means heart and vessels, and that's all that's included in that. But the overall organ system includes the blood itself also. And so that all three of those things, heart, vessel, and blood, is circulatory system. Yeah, go ahead.
One more question.
There's no limit.
Is the digestive system actually one of those official ones?
It is, yes. Okay. The 11 are digestive, lymphatic, urinary, reproductive, muscular, nervous, skeletal. What am I missing here? Integumentary, skin, hair, and nails. Did I say skeletal?
Yeah.
Did you say muscular?
Did I say nervous?
Yeah.
There's no vascular system. That's just part of the circulatory system.
Muscular.
Well, let me just do them in the order they're taught. integumentary, skeletal, muscular, nervous, endocrine, digestive, circulatory, respiratory, urinary, lymphatic, and reproductive. Okay, that's organ systems. And then, for humans, for instance, there's 11 of those. It depends on what species. But those 11 organ systems, using us as an example, then make an even more complex structure, which is the individual human. That's the organism level. And this is why I was saying before, for a bacterium, organism and cell are the same level, because it only has one cell. Well, that is as far as you go for the individual, but that's not as far as you go in biological organization, because organisms then make collections called populations. A population is a group of organisms of the same species living in a certain place. Then you have communities above that. Now, what is the difference between a community and a population?
Community is like a small bunch of people or
Well, that's what a population is already. A population is a group of species, I mean a group of individuals of the same species. Go ahead. Right, it's a group of different populations all in the same place. For instance, not just the squirrels, but the squirrels and the trees and blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's a community. Above that is ecosystem. How's that different from community? Well, you might be tempted to think that since a community is a group of populations, that an ecosystem would be a group of communities, but it's not the way it works, actually. An ecosystem is a community, which is the group of all the populations, all the species that live there, plus all of the non-living stuff as well. So the community does not include the rocks and the water and the air. The ecosystem does. See the difference? And then the highest level is the biosphere, which is called a sphere because the planet is spherical. And so far, we've only found life in or very close to the planet. Now, there is almost no chance that we're the only life. It's just because of sheer numbers. There's so many stars and planets out there that almost certainly there's life in a lot of places. But the distances between favorable places is so immense that it's also pretty likely that we'll never encounter any other life. Until we actually have proof of it, though, we have to stick with science based on evidence with what we know. And so the biosphere is, it changes in size because we keep discovering things that are living in more and more remote places. But it's actually a sphere, a hollow sphere with a wall of certain thickness. The thickness of the wall, within that thickness, is where all the organisms that are known live. So it goes down into the earth, the depth of the earth, as far as we find living things, bottom of the ocean and in rocks and stuff. And it goes as far out into the atmosphere as we find living things. Not just birds, but other things that are living in the air. Okay. Let's go on to three. The background photograph that we see here represents an ecosystem. It's not important which ecosystem it is. This is just an example. But for any given ecosystem, energy flows through the ecosystem, which means it enters the ecosystem and energy leaves the ecosystem. But the energy that enters is different from the energy that leaves. Energy enters an ecosystem as sunlight, as you see by the yellow arrow at the top. That's a form of energy, radiant energy, electromagnetic energy, electromagnetic radiation, which is what light is. That enters the ecosystem, but it quickly gets transformed and transferred. Energy gets transformed and transferred. Transformed means that it gets converted into other kinds of energy, like the chemical energy of the biological molecules that we're all made of. The energy that's in those molecules used to be in sunlight. That's transformation, or changing it into heat, for instance, is another transformation. Transference of energy refers to moving the energy from one body to another. And here by body I mean physical body, not necessarily anything that's alive. A rock is a body, an object, right? A material object. So there's all kinds of energy transformations and transference of energy, but eventually it degrades to heat. And that is what exits the ecosystem. So there's an overall flow through or throughput of energy in an ecosystem. On the other hand, for materials, meaning things that are made out of atoms, there isn't really a flow through. There's a little bit of, it's not perfectly contained, but the materials, the matter within an ecosystem stays within the ecosystem and just becomes transformed within it. So, you know, a water molecule that gets created by my metabolism might in the next moment be part of someone else's body and get transformed, get incorporated into a hormone, or it might become part of the soil, right? It's continual recycling of materials, transforming them into other materials along the way, but more or less they stay there. There's leakage, of course, from ecosystem to ecosystem, but it's unlike energy in that it's not continuous throughput. Slide 4. We can see this really in these two other... The previous slide didn't have heat coming out. This one does. Really should have for the original one. But another thing that we see here, though, in terms of energy is that... we'll talk more about this in other chapters, but there are two laws of thermodynamics that we need to talk about. Now, there aren't just two laws of thermodynamics. There are actually four laws of thermodynamics, but we only really care about two in biology courses, even though they're all important, of course. Something that's kind of weird is that they are not called the first, second, third, and fourth law. They are called the zeroth, first, second, and third law. Because once we had the first and second, then we realized actually there's something more basic we need to put in the front. They didn't renumber them. They just called it the zeroth law. That's not one we'll talk about. What we call the first law, which is really the second law, is the law of conservation of energy. Now, who wants to describe what that means? What is the law of conservation of energy in other words? What does conservation here refer to? Yeah.
Store it.
Well, use, I can, you don't consume it. It doesn't get destroyed. It does get used. Energy does get used all the time, but it doesn't get used up. That's the difference. Yeah, so another way of saying that there is a law of conservation of energy or that energy is conserved is to say that energy can't be created or destroyed. Conserved means saved. So that means however much energy is in the universe, that's what we're stuck with. It doesn't get created or destroyed. But it does get transformed and transferred, like I said. So it doesn't stay necessarily as what kind of energy it is. But the overall sum of all the energy is a constant in the universe. That's the law of conservation of energy. Now the second law, the other one that's important to biology, has to do with entropy, which, roughly speaking, is disorder. And one thing that this second law says is that the entropy of the universe is always increasing. The universe is becoming more and more disordered. You might say, well, how can organisms exist then because they're so highly ordered like we were talking about? That's only possible. It's only possible for one little subset of the universe, like an organism, to be very highly ordered and therefore have low entropy if you make the surroundings, everything else in the universe, even more highly disordered than the thing you're making ordered. So that when you add it all together, disorder is always increasing. And we'll talk much more about that in the energy unit. But that's an important part of the second law. Another important part of that is that in any energy transaction, this is still the second law, in any energy transaction... some energy gets lost as heat and can't be used to do some useful work. This is just another way of saying that there is no such thing as a 100% efficient process. A good familiar example is an internal combustion engine, which are still in most cars, sadly. They don't approach 100% efficiency. Most of the energy that is released by burning the fuels, the gasoline mixture, which you want to put into propelling you down the road, most of that really just gets wasted as heat, which is why the engine will seize up immediately if you don't have a dedicated cooling system just to keep it cool enough not to seize up. Only a small percentage of that energy actually propels you down the road. Some of it goes into noise, some of it goes into heat, and so on. Similarly with any organism, though, all of this metabolism that I'm talking about, which is your life, all of that pays the price of being at least a little wasteful, and that's why heat is always flowing out of an ecosystem. Okay, we'll talk more about energy later. Let's go on to 5, and I'll have to make this the last one. The bird wings and its bones that are in the wings here, just a good example of an important concept in biology that can be kind of phrased as form fits function. You've probably heard this phrase before, meaning that biological structures are built the way they are. They have the form or the shape that they have because of natural selection. They have that form because that form works to do a particular function. So, if you look at the skeleton of a bird, people tend to think birds are real delicate animals, but flying is really stressful. There's a lot of very stressful mechanical forces that would snap a wimpy skeleton. So they have to have a very strong skeleton, or they wouldn't exist. You could have a very strong skeleton if you had very thick, solid bones, right? But what's the problem with that if you're a bird? It's going to be heavy as hell, right? You're not going to get off the ground. And you're going to get eaten by that thing that appreciates the fact that you can't fly. So evolution by natural selection has favored bones that have become pneumatized or filled with space. And just very quickly, the reason this happens is the same reason why modern bicycles have tubes that are much wider than they used to be when they were very small, narrow tubes. If you have a given weight limit and you're designing a bike, for instance, out of tubes, you can make that tube as wide or as narrow as you want, but it can't be heavier than a limit. And so you could make it a solid rod and waste all of your mass in a very narrow diameter, right? That would be dense, but it would be easy to bend, right? Because a narrow width is easy to bend. Because when you bend something at a certain point, what you're really doing is stretching this side and compressing this side, right? Now, if you have a wider thing, you're doing the same bend, it's going to be a hell of a lot more compression and stretching, which means it's going to resist that bend. So if you make, instead of a rod, you put your material into a hollow, larger diameter cylinder, it's going to be strong and big without being heavy. And that's exactly what's happened with birds' bones. But there's countless examples of this. We are the way we are because natural selection has shaped us, simply because what works is what gets favored by natural selection. All right, I have to leave it there. Sorry, I went over a little bit.